Kiss me goodbye and write me while I'm gone. Goodbye, my sweetheart. Hello, Vietnam.
Hey, everybody, we're back with another Commission podcast. This time, special thanks go to Judd Blevins, who pulled out another Kubrick masterpiece. I want to say that because this seems like the one
that's the proper inflection for this.
Surprise! You know, I've never actually done a lot of critical reading into Full Metal Jacket, 1987's Full Metal Jacket, starring Matthew Modine, mm-hmm. Vincent D'Onofrio, and of course Arlie Ermey as the drill instructor. I haven't really done a lot
of
credit.
Adam Baldwin? He doesn't get any credit as Animal Mother.
Yeah, Adam Baldwin's mother. I didn't want to get too far because I know there's a lot of other people that I just, you know, didn't recognize. Like, honestly, if I hadn't read reviews, I don't know that I'd recognize Matthew Modine.
Right.
Modine. Yeah. Modine.
I know I've seen him in a bunch of stuff. I just can't pinpoint it.
And you
it.
Denied the validity of Vincent D'Onofrio. I'm like, that's fucking Vincent D'Onofrio.
He looks so much different, though. Like,
yeah.
He's, you know, 40 years younger.
And he gained... That's the funny thing.
He aged 40 years and 20.
Is all of the contemporary reviews of the movie mention how much weight he gained for the role.
Right.
And then he lost. He, like, gained, like... And I think he still holds the record for gaining and losing weight, although I don't... That's hard to believe with Christian Bale.
Yeah, going but from Christian the Bale's never Batman. Been hugely fat, right?
Yeah, but...
Like, oh,
but
pure weight?
Vincent D'Onofrio has not been skeletal, like, just walked out of prison
camp. He must have been before this movie, because... Like, how much, like 70 pounds he put on for this
movie? That's what I said. Well, he doesn't look
like he's that much heavier.
I don't think he put on that, but the difference between this movie and then the next movie, which I have never heard of, and they had a picture where he's pretty cut, that was 70 pounds. It's not he gained 70 pounds and lost 70 pounds.
See, I heard that he
the
gained
velocity
70.
Between the fattest that he was in. The other thing is, I think his weight fluctuates in this movie.
Yeah.
Like, he's noticeably tubbier at the beginning than
he
is.
I think his weight fluctuates throughout his life. Frankly,
well, that's the other thing. That's where I was going to, because I wonder if this early yo-yoing fucked up his metabolism, because now I don't think I've ever seen him. It's been like 20 years since I've seen him in trim,
right?
D'Onofrio mode, and then in Kingpin, I don't know if he intentionally gained weight for that role or he just started off where he left Law and Order and kept on with the jelly donuts.
Christian Bale needs to constantly do boxing and action movies. Otherwise, he's going to turn into just a bag of Jell-O.
I mean, it's probably safe to say that that's not healthy.
Yeah, no, it's
to
it's
gain
not.
And lose 70 pounds and to go to that. Did you read his diet to get the machinist weight?
No.
It was like a can of tuna and a half cup of skim milk.
Okay.
And multivitamins.
Is that like per meal?
That was his daily caloric intake.
I think you die if you do that.
Well, apparently, I mean, sure, if he didn't stop.
Yeah.
But anyway, this is not about the machinist. Maybe we can
certainly
get that commission later on.
Certainly you get like jaundice or something.
I'll let Judd explain to us why he selected this movie. He says, this has always been one of my top five favorite movies.
Top five favorite. You just shortened it.
Some kind of future Scottish accent is what he speaks with. And he says, being a former U.S. Marine, I do feel like this is the definitive movie on becoming a Marine. And being a Marine in a combat zone, although I'm an Iraq veteran and not a Vietnam veteran, I first saw this movie before I joined the Marines. And at the time, I was about 99% sure that I wanted to join the Marines. Fun fact, Cecily's mom and stepdad, and actually her real dad, are Marines. And
really?
Very, very oorah. And like I mentioned that I just watched this for the Commission podcast and got very oorah in the living room. But that speech that Arlie Ermey, Gunnery Sergeant Hartman, gives to his freshly graduated Marines about, from now on till the day you die, you're a Marine. You're part of a brotherhood. Every Marine is your brother. Most of you go to Vietnam. Some of you will not come back. But know this, the Marine Corps lives forever. And that means you live forever. That's all I was needed to give me the extra 1% of conviction that I needed to join. I think it's just because it's like most of my knowledge about Marines comes from my dad, who was a Vietnam-era naval corpsman. If you don't know, those are the medics that because every Marine's a rifleman. They don't have medics. The Navy provides them medics in the form of corpsmen. And my dad's got dozens of crazy ass Marine stories, both in his basic training that he did. I want to say that he did like half of his basic training with the Marine unit that he eventually deployed with, or maybe he did all of it. Okay. But basically, he's like full of like Marines going into town and raising hell stories and him patching them up. And also working with Matt Brewer, because he and he had an interesting love hate relationship with the Corps, with the Marine Corps, and it's kind of like a unique type of brainwashing, because you could tell that like most of his personality bristled with everything about the, you know, power structure and some of the stupidity inherent in that and serving under people that you perceive as not as smart as you, but also he fucking unabashedly loves it.
Okay.
So, I don't know. I think if you had a job where you hated what you were doing and who you were doing for, but you loved the people you're with, and also I'm not sure exactly what part of the psyche it taps into.
Yeah, it's that's a good way to start off this film. I feel there's a certain duality to that. Yes.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that's the Private Joker embodies that he is. Well, I mean, they make an explicit joke once they get in country where a colonel comes and says, "What the hell? You got a peace symbol on your lapel and Born to Kill on your helmet?" And he's trying to suggest the duality of man.
Sure.
Yeah. So yeah, it is a good way
to
start.
There's a heart and head thing there too. You know, it's interesting. Yeah, we'll talk a lot more about that, I'm sure.
It's funny because I've seen the basic training part of this movie I don't know how many times.
Everyone's seen those scenes, yeah.
But I've probably only seen the whole movie once.
Mm-hmm.
And it's whenever I'm watching on cable, it's weird. It's like if the God, it's kind of like if the Godfather, as soon as it goes to Sicily, it's like, okay, I've seen enough.
Right.
You know, it's like I don't really have any desire to go on. You know, the Godfather's something where Full Metal Jacket type of movie, when I see it on, I have to watch it until they go into Vietnam. When the boots are made for walking is when I feel like I can turn off. And I'm not sure why that is.
Well, I think the narrative gets a lot fuzzier.
Mm.
Way fuzzier after the boot camp stuff. And it's pretty fitting that he says this is kind of the definitive, like, being a Marine movie or making of a Marine movie, because it's 45 minutes of training.
Yeah.
It starts at training. It goes halfway through this film before the training ends. I don't think I've ever seen as in depth of a look at the drill instructor aspect of it and the boot camp aspect of it. So I could totally see why, if you're a Marine and you've been through these experiences, this is the movie for you, right?
Yeah. I mean, I remember I've talked to a bunch of different Marines about the authenticity of this. And, of course, Arlie Ermey is famously a drill instructor himself.
Right.
And he's since been given an honorary title of Gunnery Sergeant by the Marine Corps. But I guess the big deal between now and, like, then is that maybe drill instructors would slap you around. Nowadays, they can only resort to verbal humiliation. And they also are not quite as racist, sexist, homophobic.
Right.
Like, it's had to evolve. I mean, they still break you down and get into your head, but they're not going to call you a queer. They're not going to refer to you as the N-word.
Sure.
Or any of the other colorful racial slurs that he like, you know, I thought it was actually amusing the way he said, "I've been this, my Marines, all of you are equally worthy." Like, he uses every racial epithet I think there's ever been invented.
Uh-huh.
And then he goes, "It doesn't matter to me because all of you are equally worthless."
Yeah.
So
that's one of the things, like, halfway through this movie, when it switches to Vietnam and I start getting into that portion of it, I started realizing I don't really enjoy watching this movie very much.
Hmm.
Like, aside from some of the stuff in the training portion, the training half, let's say.
Yeah.
A lot of it is just so offensive. And I get it. Like, it's of an era. It's of a place. It's of a particular occupation. Like, these are potentially the things that went on, the things like the attitudes that people had during the time and in that place. And I get that. I just don't enjoy seeing it.
That's the thing. Like, I feel like that...
I think how I expressed it to you was, I don't like this movie.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's the proper way for me to say it. It's not that this movie is bad. I think this movie is really, really good on a lot of levels. I just don't... I can't watch some of this movie over and over again.
It's funny because this is all dovetailing with season two of Serial for me, which is finally, in my mind, kind of getting interesting. But I listen to Serial, and I get onto the subreddit, and I listen to Slate Serial Special. And it's astounding to me, and of course I've never served in any armed forces, but a lot of my family has. I've got a lot of family that's still serving, a lot of friends. You know, you're from the heartland, quote-unquote, of America, where everybody knows somebody that's gone.
Sure, yeah.
Especially now we've got a war, people know people have died, and I feel like I'm more in tune with military culture, but I'm hearing... like these very East Coast NPR liberal people talk about the military, and it's so obvious that they don't understand.
Right, yeah.
Like, you know, the things they find shocking. I'm like, is it really shocking that this kind of dialogue appears in a workplace where your profession is killing people?
Sure.
Like, there has to be a level, and I think that's, you know, in the training montages where they're sleeping with the rifles, where they're... you know, the different cadence they're singing are either vile racist, vile sexist, or vile just anti-human messages. It's all to get you comfortable with the idea of taking a person's life. And, you know, in the case of Vietnam, and I'm sure in Afghanistan and Iraq, you occasionally kill the traditional non-combatants, let's say. Whether it's women or children or people that you thought was holding a rifle, and maybe they're holding, you know, whatever. To do that as a human being and to do it effectively requires a level of detachment that I don't think people that haven't been through that or in something where people are trying to kill you, it makes them uncomfortable.
Yeah, no, I get that. And I don't know how I feel about this kind of systematic abuse and systematic offensiveness, I guess. Because I do see where it could be useful for these people when you're going into something that's so horrific.
I don't think it's like useful. War, I think it's required for survival.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I mean by useful. it keeps them alive in this situation.
Sure. And not just alive, but able to put it into this kind of over-the-top mental and emotional context that you have a prayer of putting onto the shelf when you are called home and go to civilian life.
Okay. Yeah, that's one of the problems I think I have with it is the difficulty of doing that, right? When you're so ingrained and you're broken down as a human being and all you know is this particular situation and these particular sets of values, how do you do that when you come back? I don't know. I mean, obviously I've never been in that situation and I don't know anything about PTSD or the effects of this training in particular.
But you can look at empiric data, like how much of the homeless population in America are veterans, especially combat veterans, and how many have PTSD. And then you look at, like, an open question is how well does our country deal in serving that population? And the answer is not well. I mean, I think I feel like that these levels of offensiveness, it's funny to sit back and like, oh man, they're talking about these people and I'm offended by it, but their job is to go, I mean, they were dropping napalm on these people, they're shooting them with machine guns and artillery shells and going into villages and rooting out this, and also just the... the geopolitical worldview, like it seems like this is, it seems like it's conventional wisdom to say Vietnam was a wrong-headed approach. And not just that, but in the larger context of communism versus democracy.
Okay.
Like that this was a war of ideas that had to be resisted militarily. Like, you know, communism might hoodwink the whole world in thinking that it's a viable policy. Where it seems like that you could have just let them go to their own devices and the whole thing would have collapsed within, at least the way communism was practiced by Russia and China and still practiced. But then again, you look at North Korea and maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's like, how gullible are these people versus, like, what they see in their quality of life, right?
But, I mean, I think that's where, like, I saw a lot of dismissal of this movie by contemporary reviewers saying, like, oh, man, well, you know, you came late to the party because we've already had Deer Hunter and we've had Platoon.
Sure.
And, like, Apocalypse Now is hell. We all know war is hell. But
yeah.
I feel like that it's weird because nobody ever attacks, like, a romantic comedy of boy meets girl as being formulaic.
Right.
But, like, right. Oh, you've seen one depiction of the horrors of war. You've seen them. Like, I feel that's weird because to me, it's like that's something we should keep in the forefront of the consciousness. That if this dehumanization and this racism and brutality is a unavoidable byproduct and a desirable feature of our soldiers fighting wars, then it seems like the best thing to keep in mind is... And also, it's like, I'm not a pacifist. I do believe in the necessity at time. Like, I feel like that should be in your arsenal of a state, that war should be a tool in your toolbox that, you know...
Okay.
Every once in a while, it has to be done. Like, maybe one day we'll live in a world that's not required, but I feel like nowadays, occasionally it will be.
Well,
it's just super fucking important to make sure you're not sending these young men and women off to be dehumanized for some bullshit.
Sure. I agree with you there. So there's also like a lot of problems with that, right? Like if people view war as a tool in the toolbox, how do you ever get to a state where war is no longer a tool in the toolbox? It seems self-perpetuating, right? Like to a certain degree.
Sure.
Like we need to use war so that we can stop the people who would use war. Well, I don't know how that argument really shakes out.
So would you classify yourself as a pacifist?
Ideally, I would like to be, but I'm somewhere more toward you. Like, okay. I'm not saying that I have the answer there, and I think that I do think war is probably a tool that humanity needs. Like, certain parts of humanity need to defend against other parts of humanity, because there is that dual nature to humans. But in an ideal world, yes, get that the fuck out of here. We don't need it.
I wonder, because it's something I've had conversations with my son, because my son freaks out about the concept of war. You know, he's told...
Yeah, he should.
He told on the by the other side of his family that, you know, we're all heading towards a massive Armageddon-style showdown.
Right.
And I'm like, well, actually, if you look at statistics, things are getting better and more peaceful and prosperous all the time. But it's interesting, like, if you think about a world that everyone has, every nation state has some sort of stockpile of nuclear weapons, and you just, you know, it's like it could go one of two ways. You could say, oh, well, there's a bunch of rogue states that it's going to be constant nuclear war, nuclear flare-ups, or you could say that maybe getting nuclear weapons empowers a country and also sobers it up to where, it's like, there's not a person crazy enough to not game plan... You know, to not do the war games thing. The only way to win is to never play.
I'm not certain about that, but
so
okay.
What's interesting is, like, what that would imply is that every nation just does the hell, whatever the hell it does in its own borders, which is kind of like, well, I guess, the logical end game for pacifism. Like, okay, North Korea sucks, but it's kind of North Korean's problem. Or Saddam Hussein sucks what he's doing to his people, but who's to say if you depose him, something worse is going to come along? Like,
sure.
Pervasive nuclear weapons would lead to, like, I feel like
this is more of a Dr. Strangelove conversation, honestly.
Well, I don't know.
Than a Full Metal Jacket. Full Metal Jacket is a more personal movie, right? It's not it's not about the full-scale worldwide war that Dr. Strangelove is about. It's more about the nature of humanity.
Yeah. Let's talk about Private Joker. So he goes into the Corps, and he doesn't even look kind of like your Marine. He's kind of nerdy looking. He's got these glasses.
He looks like everybody else. He's got his head shaved.
He's got his head, yes. Yeah. He's got his lumpy head shaved. I thought it was interesting a lot of the soldiers in the movie had glasses. When I think of soldiers, I don't think of them on the battlefield wearing their big nerd glasses, but...
But
obviously.
It's not like an astronaut, you know, where you can't wear, which is not even true anymore. You can wear glasses as an astronaut, no problem.
Can you? I thought you had to have corrective surgery.
No.
Really?
No. I've seen pictures of astronauts on ISS wearing glasses.
Reading glasses or real glasses?
Oh, I don't know.
Okay.
Maybe they're reading glasses, yeah.
Interesting. So I forget, you derailed me. So you got this guy, and he's kind of a philosopher. type, as the yeah. drill instructor would put it. He is, but he also kind of knows the soldiering well enough that he's promoted to the squad leader. Yeah. Also, he's do you think he's atheist or do you think he's just not Catholic?
Because
there's a scene where it's like, do you believe in the? He says, "Do you believe in the Virgin Mary?" And right. he says, "No, you know." And you feel like the instructor's about sure. to kick his ass, but
he could be Buddhist, he could be atheist, he could be any number of religions that don't believe in sure. Mary, or the divinity of Jesus, any of that stuff. I don't think it matters because that scene is there to show that he is intelligent, right? Mm-hmm. That he's a thinking person.
Yeah.
And that kind of, you know, that doesn't necessarily conflict with the job he's there to do because it gets him promoted, frankly.
Yeah.
He sees that he's smarter than whoever the other guy is. The other guy is not a good actor. The other guy runs up shouting just a little too loud, getting mm-hmm. a little too gung-ho about it.
Mm-hmm.
He's demoted.
I don't know if he can shout too loud in this man's Marines.
I think, yeah, he shouted. If it's possible to shout too loud, this guy did it.
Huh. All right. It is funny because it reminds me of a story Mad Drew told that I guess in, you know, he was in 10, 15 years ago, and that he wanted to put atheist in on his paperwork, you know. Okay. And I guess like several higher ups got in his face screaming that that's not allowed and you can't yep. do that. And he found out after he took all the abuse and was like, no, I don't want to talk to the fucking chaplain and I'm an atheist and I don't want to do your bullshit prayer in the morning and all this other stuff, that one of the higher ups actually marked out that he put atheist and put non-denominational on his paperwork. That he wow. took the time and went back and corrected. So it's weird that even in the 21st century that the armed forces seem like they're, you know, there's like, there's the saying that there's no atheists in foxholes, which I think right. is false. Sure. But it's like that seems to be something that they cherish, that there's like really God and country and that's all wrapped up in the armed forces.
It helps when you're going to, you know, what could be considered an almost assured death. At the very least, it's not super likely that you're coming back if you're on the front. That could be a useful tool as well, right? Some kind of faith.
I guess. I mean,
and that could have easily gone wrong with anybody other than
yeah.
his particular drill instructor.
I mean, everybody says like, oh, that's a way to find, you know, like peace and courage. If you think in the afterlife, then and this life isn't it. But I don't know. I feel like a lot of heroism comes down to just snap decisions in the heat of the moment. Like,
sure.
you know, someone's about to get run over by a bus and you see it's happening and you see what's going to happen and you step in and you throw the person out of the way and maybe you get ran over instead, but you didn't think like, oh, I'm putting my life in more. It's just kind of like almost a reflex instinct to save or help someone. And then when
but at the same time, like these people aren't going into battle reflexively. They're going into battle knowing full well what they're doing.
Well, I'm saying once battle starts, I don't know that
right.
there's a whole battle like, oh, man, I'm glad I believe in Jesus or else I wouldn't, you know, storm this machine gun nest. Or thank God I got heaven looked forward or I would just sit and shit my pants at the bottom of this hole that I dug. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I don't know. I mean, my personal views on religion probably cloud my judgment here a little bit. But I think, like, the sort of unquestioning nature of believing in a religion and believing in a God kind of lend themselves toward people who are willing to follow these orders without question.
So this is a really meandering discussion of Private Joker, just a reminder
right.
of where I'm trying to go here. He's assigned to deal with this Private Pyle, mm-hmm. who's named after Gomer Pyle. His real name's Leonard, and he's played by Vincent D'Onofrio as kind of a chubby Forrest Gump. He's
sure.
obviously got not just mental development issues. He's got some emotional development issues. And he's singled out for abuse by... It's kind of hilarious, honestly, some of the stuff that drill instructor... I almost said drill sergeant, which I guess is an army thing, not a marine thing.
Apparently, yeah.
But he's just not cutting the mustard. He won't stop eating jelly donuts. He's not taking the PT. He can't do his drills right. He can't put his rifle together. So Joker is assigned to kind of be this guy's mother. And at first he does it diligently. He's like very patient. And he's just like, you know, and you can tell that Pyle is starting to kind of blossom under this. But then he eats the jelly donut and he gets the whole, you know, the whole squad in trouble.
Gets a beating.
And he gets a code, essentially a code red.
Right.
You know, the load did put the soap in the pillowcases. They tight blanket him and then they beat him. And Joker gives him the most savage of the beatings.
Yeah.
What's your analysis of this scene?
He's arguably
the guy that feels the worst about it, though, and the most guilty.
He does, but then I feel like once he gives into that, like, the thing that he's got to do, he's also the most resentful of it, right? Because he's put the most
effort
into it.
Yeah.
And he feels like if he's also angry at himself. I feel like there's a little bit of that.
Sure.
Like, I should have been able to help this guy a little bit more. I'm going to beat him just a little bit harder.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's a lot of confusing, conflicted notions within Joker.
Yeah, I don't know. That's other things. Like, I don't know if you've ever been forced to deal with a person. Like, I mean, there's that frustration when you're dealing with a person that has limitations.
Okay.
I feel like that's, like, the root cause of why there's so many horrific things that go on in, like, psych wards and mental institutions, just because day in, day out of, like, the frustration, you know, like, if, you know, you're checking out at a grocery store and the cashier is perceived as less intelligent than you. And I'm not talking about full-on retardation or anything. They're just annoying to you. Imagine that if your job was to deal with dozens or hundreds of those types of people, just the sheer frustration that would... And I feel like that if you're going into battle with somebody like that, then it's weird because you want to judge Joker and be like, that's not cool, man.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, it's like, well, why the hell is Leonard here in the first place? Do we need bodies over there so desperately that you can't fail this guy out of the Marines?
Yeah, and I mean, not failing him out, not... What do they call it? It's like aiding him or something.
Yeah, sure.
I guess that's being evaluated psychologically unfit.
There's probably different ways. You could probably get it from physical, like if you got the flat feet or...
Yeah.
Contextually,
I felt like Section 8 was mentally kicking people out, but I don't know why. But there's also the danger to that, right? Like, he could cost soldiers their lives.
Yeah, I mean, think about the outburst he has in the head happened four weeks in the country, and he slits everybody in his platoon's throat, you know?
Yeah, or he's just unable to mentally push through a situation where he has to perform, and he gets his squad killed.
What do you think happens to Leonard? Because his low point is him getting beat, and he's sobbing, and I thought that's the other interesting thing about the Joker, is that he's the one that, you know, he really is troubled by the man crying, and he's trying to cover his ears, he doesn't hear it. But then it seems like Leonard gets with the program and becomes kind of like the ultimate Marine. You know, kind of in the way, you know, he kind of does like the Forrest Gump thing.
Just to be clear, Leonard is Joker, right?
Leonard is Pyle.
Leonard is Pyle?
Yes.
Shit. See,
yes.
I only know their names, their nicknames.
He's a good shot. He's like the best shot in the unit. He can break down his rifle. But Joker notices he's starting to talk to himself.
Mm-hmm.
What happens? I what happens psychologically to this guy that turns him into the Jack Nicholson-esque figure that blows the gunnery sergeant away?
So that's where I feel like a little bit of the narrative of this movie falls apart. Like, I think the narrative is stronger in the first half, but there's this leap that they make from Joker getting really, really good at one thing. Still kind of, you know, not being
Pyle.
Great. Yeah, sorry, not Joker. I don't even know him by their nicknames, apparently.
Yeah.
But yeah, Pyle getting really, really good at one thing. To him just going full-on insane. And I didn't feel like the movie earned that.
Yeah.
I felt like he was coming back up. Like, he was on the uptick, and then all of a sudden he's gone.
Yeah. It just also didn't ring true with my experience dealing with people with those kind of limitations. Like, maybe he'd go withdrawn to himself, but, like, to go full-on homicidal, like to display some kind of psychopathy on top of the other things didn't... It's like... that would be what would happen if you'd snap a guy like Joker. It wouldn't be like what would happen if you'd snap a guy like Pyle.
Yeah, I don't know. Especially, I mean, I'm sure like each case is.
Also, I saw the Room 237 different. Right before I saw, like, a couple days before this, and they made it, like, they had the homage of the Stanley Kubrick Wolverine face, or whatever you call that, like, you know, head down, eyes up, kind of demonic face. And I'm like, it also, I agree with something Roger Ebert said in his reviews, that he felt like that Kubrickian touch ruined the scene, because the tension of whether this guy's going to do something crazy, it's like, you look at that guy's face and you know he's going to do something crazy.
I thought the performance was a little over the top, like they say about Jack Nicholson.
Yeah, they pulled it back like a good 50%.
Yeah.
And made him be a little bit more placid, and then he just, from that standpoint, shoots the sergeant. That, I thought, would have been shocking and kind of... Because I even the way they played it, I started to think right before Gunny started screaming at him that he's going to be able to take the gun from him.
Yeah,
And if they played Leonard just a little bit more subtly, I think that would have been had a lot more tension to it.
I felt it's strange to say this in a movie that spends 45 minutes on basic training, but I felt like that was rushed. I honestly felt like the narrative,
a little Anakin structure all the there younglings.
Was rushed a little bit. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff about the narrative that I think is intentionally broken down here, but I don't think that's part of it.
Mm. I feel like this is the least Kubrickian movie I've ever seen.
In what way? Well, how would you describe Kubrickian to someone who didn't innately understand that?
Like, it's you're aware of how much what you're seeing is art, and that how artificially constructed the shots are. Like, the way that the background extras are moving with the camera movements, and the way the shots are composed, so the geometric shapes all line up. This felt like Stanley Kubrick saying, you know what, fuck it, I just want to make a war film. There were some beautiful shots. I think the best one is at the end of the movie where they're singing Mickey Mouse Clubhouse song and they're walking in front of this burning building.
But I also felt like there were also some shots that were strangely overstructured. Like, for instance, the thing when they get to Vietnam and they're kind of dollying down this line of soldiers, of
that
Marines.
Was weird, yes.
And they're all delivering their line one after the next, each piecing together the puzzle of this joke.
But what's weird about, even weirder, is that's the tail half of it. The first half is just pretty much standard Marines with their 1,000-yard stares.
Kind of what I was expecting that shot to stay.
What was Kubrick trying to say with that? Like,
I don't... No.
Like, here's the real soldiers, and now I'm going to my actor. Yeah, there was something off-putting about that shot.
There's also something... There's
something very deliberate about how the camera guy's being led. I mean, it's this elaborate, like, three-buddy system where they're tugging each other's... I don't know.
I
like,
get
they
it.
Gotta
that's
hold
how
them.
Films... That's how movies are made, right?
Why, like, are all three of them duck walking? Why does...
One guy's holding the camera, one guy's holding the mic, because those are separate entities.
And then the other guy...
And the other guy's leading them so they don't trip on their own dicks and fall over.
Okay, yeah. Okay. So it's that you're just running reverse train on
He's
them.
The spotter.
Okay. Yeah. All right, fine.
I didn't see anything weird about that. It's just the structure. It felt too structured in a weird way.
No, the meta of this film, watching this filmmaking crew making a movie, and you're making a movie of that. And then when it gets so Hollywood, and you've got Dan Harmon calls that something. I forget that line where everyone's statement, like, it has to be scripted. There's no way natural dialogue works where... It's God damn it, what is it called? Anyway, it's like this multi-level joke where everything feeds into itself, and it just goes on to absurdity. I felt like that he's trying to make some kind of comment on the artificiality.
Like, yeah, I suppose
I'm making
he could
a movie
be.
About war as hell, but even this is the Disney-fied version of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just seems strange to me in a movie where part of his goal is to. From the interviews I read, part of his goal here was to kind of explode the narrative, as he calls it, the narrative structure.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want to have kind of this standard through line, which I feel is in the first half of this movie, right? It's rushed, but it's there with Pyle. You know, he starts off as this doofus who can't do anything right. He eventually is coached to mediocrity and even excellence in a certain manner.
Mm-hmm.
And then that pays off with him going insane. And I... and killing people. I think that's a fairly typical narrative structure, like a three-part act that you'd see in anything. But then, like, he uses the second half of this movie to totally subvert that and kind of confuse the narrative in a way that I think is kind of interesting because of the subject matter. Like, you've got Joker, you've got this very structured thing of basic training, right? And that has the very basic narrative structure of a film. And then kind of when Joker loses his mind and shoots it and blows everything up, the narrative itself is blown up. And then it gets kind of muddy and confusing, much like the situation that these characters are in.
Yeah.
And I think the narrative is kind of reflected in the scenario in a weird way.
The name Private Joker is very reminiscent of the term a private joke. Do you think that there is any kind of intent with that? That this about the way the guy sees it? And I feel like there's a little bit of that. Like, this John Wayne is kind of something he does more for himself than anybody. And just the way he sees the world and the fact he's got the peace symbol with the helmet. Like, that's the stuff that... That's his way of coping with the dehumanization of everything. That he's got this layer of humor he's abstracted the world with.
Yeah, detachment.
And it falls apart at the very end when he's forced to kill this little girl, quote-unquote sniper.
Yeah.
But then it's firmly put back onto his face in the final Mickey Mouse scene. Is that artificial? Or is he just, you know, is that kind of showing us how... You know, basic the kind of training these guys go through to desensitize them is effective, and that he's just all that shit he's just sloughed off. Like something so effective.
I feel like that's something innate to Joker, honestly. Like I feel like he brought that in with him. Like that part, like that detachment and cynicism wasn't necessarily something the army wanted to instill in him. Although it's kind of reflected with all of the journalists, right?
Right.
I mean, you've got the group of what I view as, you know, almost interns, the newbies. And then you got the head journalist. I don't know any of the proper terms for these guys.
Sure.
But he's kind of the one who's been in the shit and knows what he's talking about and doesn't have that kind of detached cynicism.
I'm glad I'm back here with the gear in the rear.
Though I feel like he has maintained some form of cynicism, right? Like, you don't put that fucking first to go, last to know banner up unless... The guy running the show says it's cool.
Yeah.
So he's obviously got this tongue-in-cheek feeling about the thing that they're doing, portraying this war in a certain light. Even though maybe that's not how it's going, they're kind of spinning the story. So like I feel like the journalism side of this war kind of all have that tongue-in-cheek attitude.
Yeah, and it's also interesting.
But maybe not the detachment. It's
another way it dovetails in this. What I'm watching is Serial, because the last episode dealt with like the concept of counterinsurgency operations, what they call COIN, where it's the hearts and minds. You're trying to win the hearts and minds, and like you know, these people in Afghanistan, they don't want to be Taliban. They want to be essentially like us. They want to be in a broadly Western-style democracy where they can choose to do whatever they want. Versus the view that, no, all these people are kind of savage and they want to put medieval politics and religious practices in place and we're kind of pissing up a rope here. And I thought that was that duality was nicely illustrated by the one guy who had the opinion that said, besides inside every slur that refers to Vietnamese, there's an American trying to get out... Versus the I thought it was interesting. The first scene we see of them in the Vietnam is of this Vietnamese hooker propositioning them, and all throughout the training montage, you've seen that they have conflated in the minds of these recruits the idea of sexuality and violence.
Okay,
like you know, this is my rifle, this is my gun. And all the songs about fucking Eskimo girls and whatnot.
And like being married to your rifle, there are no more.
Yeah, or sleep with your gun.
Yeah.
And now this girl she refers to sex as boom boom. Which is kind of interesting. And
sure. Reminiscent of a bomb, certainly.
Yeah, and also the lyrics to Boots Are Made for Walking about like, you know, you've been telling this one thing, but you're really about the other is kind of like the way that's it's one of the COIN guys on the Serial podcast says He said it's interesting that if you go in and you there's this tribal elder, first time you roll into a village and you're in your Humvees, and a tribal elder would go out and he'd greet you, and he'd say, "Why are you here?" And you know, the official response is to be like, "Well, we're here to build roads for you and to build power stations and help you build schools and get sanitized water, and we're just here to help." And he would go back to the village and they'd be like, "Why are they here?" He's like, "Oh, this is a bunch of bullshit. They're here to promote American ideals and eliminate a religion." Because it's the idea that someone would just come in this country that's been torn by war for like 50 years now and just help. It's like, this is such patent bullshit to them that they don't believe it. He's like, this guy's saying like a better message would have been to come in there. He's like, "Look, we just want these Taliban guys. We want, above all else, Osama bin Laden. And as soon as we get him, we're going to ghost."
Yeah.
Like, that's a story that they would believe. But I think it's interesting here in Vietnam, they show that tension with the, you know, the bickering over the prostitute, and then the fact that the guy steals his camera.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of a Yankee go home message. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny because that's a message we here at home don't even believe most of the time. Right. And we say we're spreading democracy, and I don't think that's the case. Everyone's looking for the other reason.
Can you spread democracy?
Good question.
I mean, it's worked.
I don't know.
Like, I guess the big success would be the Empire of Japan.
Okay.
We came into that country, completely destroyed its social order, replaced it, wrote its constitution, and said, "Now we're going to stand over you with a club for a couple years until you get this an idea," and it kind of worked. But is that because I'm almost every other country that's embraced democracy has been through internal turmoil and revolution. Like, is that something that you can enforce? Is the reason that was enforced because something very peculiar to that culture and philosophy?
That's a good question. I don't know enough about Japan or even America to tell you, frankly.
I spent a lot of this weekend reading about, like, World War I and the Marshall Plan the thing we did in Japan, and also, like, why we fought communism. And what they were trying to do, and what they feared would happen, and that's the things. Like, when you look at some of the decisions they made, you don't use the benefit of hindsight. Some of these don't look terrible in the light of, you know, 1960s or 1950s day. It's like,
yeah, I mean, there's a lot of rhetoric around communism.
Because
right?
what if we lived in an alternate world where the Western style democracies just became extremely isolationist and did whatever, let communism spread unchecked, would we have large sections of the world run like South or North Korea?
Or would it kind of work itself out?
Yeah, but that's the thing. Like, I think that's what, Orwell talked about. Like, if a state gets to a point like in North Korea where the propaganda is so extreme that you can't even think straight, what is the mechanism to which you're hijacking the mechanism humanity has to foment opposition ideas and put them into play? Like, you're fucking with their history, you're fucking with their vocabulary, and like a lot of these, you know, Stalinist style authoritarian communism regimes would do that. So it's like, it seems like, yes, they would mostly fall apart, and you could make an argument that North Korea would fall apart if it wasn't for China propping them up, and them, you know, right now they're doing it. They just lobbed a ballistic missile at Japan, and I'm sure in the next couple of weeks we're going to hear about new sanctions and then new foreign aid, and it's like they're hungry, so now they're rattling their sabers. It's you could probably say that North Korea might have fallen over if they weren't propped up, but
I think it's
at
there's
the time
also,
it was a scary thing. Like, what happens if the whole world looks like 1984?
Well, I think there's a quality of life thing that also people won't put up with at a certain level. You can only have everyone being shit on for a certain amount of time before there's revolt and they change it.
How do you explain, though, because North Korea is a fucking... That's like... Is that the
for
exception
like
to prove the
been
rule?
That way. I don't know. I mean, there are certainly different tolerances for each people, right? Like, who's to say that 20 years from now, 50 years from now, they won't get fed up with it and change it? I don't know. Maybe we're watching that experiment because we're not moving in on North Korea. We're not doing the same things we're doing in the Middle East. So maybe we'll see that experiment play out.
Yeah,
and like, maybe 100 years from now, nothing will have changed there.
And I wonder if we'll be there'll be criticism of like how many wasted generations in North Korea lived and died in
and
futility.
Maybe we should have done something when we didn't. And it's kind of the direct opposite where we shouldn't get involved.
I mean, the whole Israel situation exists because of a lot of guilt over the Holocaust. And can't ever let this happen again, except when we do.
But, and the question becomes like, how long do you prop that up? Right?
Do
you just in perpetuity?
And like you can argue, like,
continue
well,
to prop
maybe
that
wasn't
up?
The best thing to do. Maybe we could have done something different. But now that it has been done, what's our obligations to? Yeah. I mean, that's the kind of thing with Iraq and Afghanistan. Like, what is our obligation to stay in there and try to provide stability? Since we destabilized it.
Right. And those are, you know,
complicated issues that no one really has a easy. If you have an easy answer, you're probably wrong.
Sure. I have no answer. So how about that?
What do you think about the depiction of the U.S. soldier? I suspect that, you know, since we're talking about a Marine commissioning this podcast and saying it's his top five movie, that he doesn't feel like this is an overly terrible depiction of a U.S. soldier.
I think it's a nuanced depiction.
I do too.
And I think that services the Marines more than any one-sided view would.
Yeah.
I think it allows people to come at it with their own perspectives and ideas and make their judgments as opposed to being spoon-fed.
Yeah, it's a lot more positive than like Platoon or, you know, which kind of portrayed the American soldier as a bunch of junkies and insubordinates, superior officer killing guys. And it's more fair than probably, or more positive than The Deer Hunter. That showed like the massive psychological and also made up a bunch of stuff about maybe different atrocities were committed. I thought this, like, it showed, like, unflinching. Like, this is the shit that happened in country, but you also understand why it got that way.
Right. I think this is more fair in that it's less subjective, right?
Like you can, I feel like the movie invites you to criticize the policy, but how can you criticize the soldiers implementing the policy given?
Sure. Yeah.
And that's the other thing I think that dovetails nicely into Serial, because the central... I feel like this season's been weird this way, but the central mystery in Serial is why did this guy do this thing that he did? Why did he walk off base? Why did he try to provoke this Dust One thing? Mm-hmm. And did he have the right to do so? Was that something justified as a soldier? Can you just decide, I don't like the way this is happening, so fuck this, I'm going to break ranks? And also, can you come up with an opinion on that? That would work if, like, you know, if you believe that wars have to happen, then you need your soldiers to fight that war, whether or not they personally agree with the with the philosophies behind it. I mean, that's, again, goes back to my thing is, like, it's the civilian leadership's job to make sure you don't put them in bullshit wars where they have to do bad stuff for no good outcome. But once they make the decision to go to war, do you want the soldiers deciding for themselves, this is bullshit, I'm going to fight it?
Yeah,
I'm going to protest this thing because I think it's unjust or wrong or immoral.
And I think, so you just hit on what I think is the distinction that needs to be made is something that is politically incorrect and something that is morally objectionable. And I feel like the soldier, the Marine, you know, Navy officer, whatever, has the duty... the human duty to probably judge moral versus immoral.
I'm not talking war crimes. I don't think killing this girl with pigtails is a war crime.
No.
She had a rifle and she was shooting at you.
I think it was fairly justified and almost compassionate in the way that the end of this film is portrayed. I don't think Joker did anything wrong there. Even though, like, it's strange to me. Let's talk a little bit about the ending.
Okay.
If you don't mind jumping around.
I feel like there's a lot of symbolism in there, too.
So, it's bizarre to me because I felt, watching that scene, that what these people did was totally justified from every single angle.
Yep.
I think when you have a sniper shooting at you and has already killed multiple men... You go in and you shoot them. You take them out. You eliminate the threat because that is a mortal threat. Mm-hmm. Fine. Done. And I think when Joker walks up and everybody's like, oh, man, what do we do here? We can't kill her. I think Joker killing her is more compassionate than it is revenge. Certainly revenge is mixed up in there. His friend, fucking, what's his name?
Yeah.
The pile of shit. I didn't know they stacked Mother? Shit that high.
Oh, well, no. That's the cowboy.
Yeah, yeah. So it's revenge for that, too, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it is revenge, but it's also compassionate.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the dualities of this movie. I don't understand why they're all like, hardcore, man, at the end of that. Because I felt he did what needed to be done.
If you, as an outside observer, I guess it's like, if you're judging American servicemen on what, you're grading them on their morality here, uh-huh. their ethics. It's like, all right, so you shot the threat, you eliminated the threat.
Right.
That's all fine. That's justifiable.
Totally.
What you got do what you should do, what's unconscionable, and then what's understandable. Like, what you should do is take this girl and get her medical attention, or at least try, right? Like, a perfectly virtuous Marine would have shot the girl and then dragged her off to the field, or at least tried to evacuate her to a field hospital where she can get care.
Here's my question.
The unconscionable thing to do would be to leave her there to die slowly.
Absolutely, yeah.
The understandable thing is the mercy killing.
Yeah.
Right? That's how I guess I judge it.
I guess I have a question to pose to you about the morality of the first statement, which is the proper thing to do here is to get her medical treatment. If this was a 30-year-old male,
mm-hmm.
what's the proper thing to do?
It's same the same. Thing? I'm saying that's the
okay.
moral thing to do. I think what the laws of war, quote unquote, the laws of war expect you to do is once an enemy is incapacitated to treat them.
But it seems to me like the movie was saying this is something particularly shocking because it's a 14-year-old girl shooting at you.
Well, no. I mean, that's...
Once the shooting starts, I kind of view them all the same.
However, I mean, you're talking about... So, yeah, I mean...
It's on a meta scale, yes, it's sure. more horrific. Because you have these innocent people... pushed into this action,
right?
This
and also
girl...
you got to deal with the inherent sexism, which, you know, it's more disturbing to shoot a young boy than an old man. It's even more disturbing to shoot a woman than a man, and then a young girl is like the worst.
I disagree. I think in this context,
how?
Because they are shooting at you and trying to kill you.
No. I'm saying that, like, I'm not saying they're wrong. I'm saying that I feel like most men in this era of time and still today would see shooting a boy as more objectionable than shooting a man, and shooting a little girl would be more rough on your conscience than all of them, because the perceived helplessness and innocence is on a sliding scale. Girls are sugar and spice. And
I agree with that out of context, but mm-hmm. in this context, I totally disagree. The playing field is 100% leveled once the shooting starts.
You think that's what Mother and Joker and Cow and the other guys would felt about it, watching that girl dying?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, so what context are you talking about?
The context of this person is trying to kill me.
Yeah, you don't think about that, but I'm saying the scale of that's pretty fucked up. It's a lot higher that she's a girl than she was a boy.
I don't understand why they're so concerned about, like, killing this person who was trying to kill them a moment ago and would still try to kill them if given the opportunity.
Because they're no longer a threat. It's the difference between defending yourself and being sadistic.
Right, but I don't see them getting her out of there and getting her medical attention.
Right. Okay.
So what are your two options then that you're left with?
So you're saying why did everyone say hardcore?
Yeah, why are they like... Hardcore, man, because she was a 14-year-old girl.
But don't you think that was a springboard to turn it back into a joke? Like, I felt like that was...
Really? Because I didn't feel jokey at that moment.
No, I didn't either, but I felt like that's how... It's kind of like in the book, and maybe even the film, The Right Stuff. That's like what all, you know, the test pilots would do to make themselves feel better about it, is they wouldn't say, oh man, it sucks that this guy went up and this plane disintegrated. It'd be like, right. This guy fucked up, because if I was in that plane, I would have flipped this switch, and I would have done this with the joystick, and I would have kept the G's under here, and I would have feathered this, and I wouldn't have died in that exact... This guy is essentially caused his own stupidity, and the fact that he was missing the right stuff got himself killed. Their mechanism was to essentially trying to turn this back into gallows humor. And sure enough, the next scene, you see him marching in this hellish
right.
Armageddon-type landscape singing the Mickey Mouse Club song.
Yeah, I didn't get that from the particular wasn't that hardcore comment.
It's kind
comment.
Of like the same way that like the Muppets, the Waldorf and whatever, the old guys in the balcony, every uh-huh. once in a while they're like, that's pretty good. It wasn't terrible. Well, it wasn't good either. They'd like talk themselves into the criticism. I felt like that was like, oh, that's pretty messed up, was a springboard for them to eventually find the gallows humor in it.
Okay. And also, it was a connecting piece for the movie.
Yeah. Like, the other thing is, like, I thought that was interesting is how the guy who shot her, he was so amped up from the act of doing the killing that the somberness of it took him a long time, if he ever felt it at all, to get to. Because he's still doing, like, this sexually suggestive stuff over her corpse, which I thought was also something Kubrick was doing. You spent the first half of the movie kind of laughing and chuckling at these guys doing dick jokes with their rifles, and then you're introduced to Vietnamese women as essentially whores to be used, and then you have the actual little girl being fucked by the rifle.
Yeah, it's
the imagery is disturbing, and it's intentionally, and it makes you feel retroactively bad for enjoying the techniques that the Marines use to induce this state into the soldiers.
Yeah, I mean, that's partially why I didn't view that hardcore thing as a joke. Like, they're all kind of keen on getting this first kill, even Joker himself, sure. right? Like, he wants to get out in the shit. He wants to get the first...
It's a duality of man.
First kill, I know. And that's like, I don't think there's a joke in that moment. I really don't think there's a joke in that moment. I think there's visceral reactions to these things by different ones.
So yeah, I'm not saying that
people.
That's messed up or that's hardcore was a joke. I'm saying that if all of them just sat there in respectful silence.
Yeah, okay.
Like that was the words were just injected into something we don't know. It's kind of like, what do you say? What do you say?
Because silence is too much.
So that starts that's the lubrication that they then get to where they talk themselves in and rationalize
it. I'm with you there. Okay. Yeah.
But also, I think there's a lot of interesting looks into like what it's like to be a soldier. Like the point where they took the black soldier and made him go out and scout this building where they knew there was a sniper.
Yeah, that's not cool.
That's terrifying.
That's not cool, man.
Being a scout or a tunnel rat or is like, I go out there and see if someone shoots you, essentially.
Right.
You got your back.
Someone's got to do it. You know, it's not like...
And the tension was super
effective.
They
can just sit there forever. Yeah.
And then the idea of your buddy being shot on the battlefield and he's out there bleeding. I mean, Dan Carlin talked a lot about that in World War I, like, because that's kind of this is a relatively new phenomenon in war. In most wars, you don't sit across from each other in these fortified positions and have no man's land where, you know, someone gets shot out there. It doesn't make a lot of sense to go out and get them, but everything and your being and your training and this esprit de corps wants you to go out there and get that guy.
Right. And I feel like, so there's a lot of hypocrisy in some of this that I saw, like with Animal Mother in particular. Animal Mother is the embodiment of the action hero, right? Mm-hmm. To a large degree. He's strapped with bullets. He's got the chain-fed machine gun.
The one's got the
he's willing to run out into the shit when
nobody
else is.
He's the heavy weapons guy.
He's almost a joke, right?
Right.
I mean, I'm certain there are guys like that in the military. I don't want to say that there aren't.
Sure.
But he's supposed to be the embodiment of a typical war hero movie hero.
Uh-huh.
So he runs out there against the direct orders of his commander.
Sure.
You know, it works out for him. He gets lucky. He doesn't get shot by this sniper.
Doesn't work out for Cowboy.
Doesn't work out for Cowboy at all, certainly. But then later on, he's like trying to give orders. Like, Cowboy's gone. I'm the commander of this thing.
Right.
Now you're going to follow my fucking orders.
Your last act before of a non-officer type character was to disobey the order of your superior.
Exactly. And that's the kind of thing where... I can't imagine that happens very often in the military. Like, to disobey a direct order is the highest form of
that's what I'm saying. Like, it's interesting.
What's the word I'm looking for? Betrayal.
Yeah.
Of treason, almost.
Well,
you know?
I mean, the military doesn't work if people did that. Because nobody wants to go out and get shot. So when your captain
and then if,
or lieutenant or whatever says, go and take this...
Right.
area, you go.
And it has to be punished extremely harshly because
right.
the first time it happens, no one starts. People start disobeying orders because no one takes them seriously sure. because they can be disobeyed.
Yeah.
And that's I felt like they never even addressed that in this movie,
yeah.
which is unfortunate.
You know, this other thing is I thought it was in speaking of another parallels I saw in this week's serial is that so the one guy who walked off the base and you know started this whole shit and got ended up captured by the Taliban for several years. Mm-hmm. One of the things he cited was the fact that his superior officers were like just really sticklers over the stuff he thought was stupid. Like okay. they come back from this battle that they fought over a broken down truck, essentially, that they needed to, you know, they wanted to haul this. The commander told them to get this, retrieve this vehicle that got blown up by an RPG. Mm-hmm. And they get up there, it's got no tires. The mechanic's like, this thing's blown up. What the fuck do you want me to do about it? Do you want us to drag?
And it weighs 2 tons.
As we're getting down this mountain, as right. we're getting fire on all sides. And they do it. They yeah. do it. And they get back, and the first thing the CO says on base is, you guys didn't have fucking time to fucking shave out there because they all have 5 o'clock right. shadow and whatnot. And he's like, not how are you doing? Boy, it was rough out in there. And the other story he told is that they were all digging ditches. And the CO pulled up and got all in their faces because they weren't wearing their heavy body armor and they weren't wearing their hats and they had taken off their shirts and they're out of uniform.
Okay.
And then, so, and when you listen to the soldier talk about it, it's like, man, that seems like a bunch of bullshit. But then they interviewed a CO and he's like, look, one of the things that they taught us about the lessons we learned in World War II and Korea and Vietnam is breakdowns in discipline. Like, you know, you overlook things like uniform policy and haircuts and whether you shave or not. That's like the broken wind. That's like the military's version of broken wind. That's how you get like the My Lai massacre. Like there's like,
what is that?
That's where you got GIs just gunning down civilians and, oh, and okay. raping villages and stuff like that. It's like,
yeah,
you could, and this military's decision-making process, they see that like, you know, just like, Giuliani said, you let a piece of graffiti in a street and a broken window. Next week, you got crack dealers. Week after that, you got people getting gunned down the street. You let people not shave and not yeah. wear their uniform, and then they start disobeying other direct orders, and then they start massacring civilian population. It's like, okay, so from the GI's perspective, it's a bunch of bullshit rules. From the commander's perspective, we're worried about not letting this thing get out of control. Mm-hmm. And I thought it's interesting that there's one point in the movie where Private Joker, he's narrating something, and he says, the Marines don't want robots. Hmm. And yet, what you just okay. said conflicts, like, there's conflicting here. It's like, yeah, you don't want these people to be unquestioning robots, but on the other hand, every once in a while, you got guys like Mother deciding they want to get payback, and right. disobeying direct orders.
And there's some kind of balance there, but how do you find it?
Yeah. War. I mean, fighting wars is a super complicated.
I mean, it's. I don't think it's controversial to say it's the most extreme thing that humanity does.
Probably, and it's also not. I mean, that's the other thing is like it's not purely a human thing. Like even among the primates, it's well documented that the various tribes of apes and monkeys go to war and commit
yeah.
fratricide and infanticide and fucked up repugnant shit.
Sure.
That is still in our that's still buried in our DNA and in our, you know, the deep part monkey parts of our brains.
Right.
And it's
right. So it's goes without saying there're going to be a lot of complicated
yeah.
aspects to yeah. it.
Which goes again, it's like, you know, once you that's why you really have to go into war with sober and sound judgment because
yeah.
once you let that genie out of the bottle, you can't be like, oh, well, fuck. We didn't intend to kill civilians. We didn't intend our soldiers to be involved in this potential war. Well, that's what happens when you ask people to shoot at people that they consider not human. And they consider them not human so they can actually shoot them and right. live with themselves.
Right. And I think that's the reason why this movie is so good is because yes. it doesn't try to make heroes or bad guys. What it tries to do is just present you with the reality of it, the truthfulness of the situation. I felt like
it was maybe the most nuanced Vietnam
yeah.
film I've ever seen.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think maybe
that's what a lot of people say. Well, maybe it's slightly more pro-American because I guess my bias would be a little slightly pro-American.
But I think you bring that to it. I don't think this movie has a lot of that in it.
Yeah.
I think it's more about showing you the war.
Right.
Showing you what these people are going through to do the job that they need to do in this extreme situation.
But I thought that's another case. Like, we talked about the boots are made for walking prostitute scene, how that was kind of a commentary on the futility of the war. I thought that Cowboy's death, as a commanding officer on the scene, he was in denial the whole time. As he's bleeding out, he's like, you know, what was his, I wrote down his direct quote, I can hack it. Like, the whole time as he's dying, like, I've got this, I'm holding it together.
And then he dies.
Do you think
it's
representative of the U.S. command structure dealing, like, you know, this is a movie set in the Tet Offensive, which, in hindsight, we find out that was, like, the last-ditch effort for the Viet Cong to push America out of the country. And if you know, it's debated that if America held on for a little bit longer, then that was it.
Yeah.
Then, you know, we wouldn't have a North and South Vietnamese, and it wouldn't have fallen to the communists. But they didn't. Whatever. Do you think the Cowboy is supposed to be a stand-in to the military and civilian leadership that's just like, no, we've got this. We just need a little bit more troops and a couple more months and a couple more bombs.
Maybe,
like, I thought that was an interesting commentary, that you got this guy who's clearly dying and he just won't accept it.
Yeah, I don't know. The stuff that I read from Stanley Kubrick about this film was that he was more interested in the truthfulness of the movie and not the narrative of it.
What does that mean?
I want to take him, like, just showing the situation and not constructing a particular narrative. Just like he says that the most interesting thing about any situation is the truth behind it.
But what does he see as the truth in U.S. involvement in Vietnam and the soldiers' experience there? Like, that's an interesting thing to say.
That's not the kind of truth. Like, the proper perspective is not what he's looking for.
Right.
The truth of the situation is what he's looking for. The truthfulness of what actually happened, not any kind of perspective on it.
That seems artificial to me, because part of the truth that he's portraying, it takes place in a certain set in time, and how you perceive the rightness or wrongness or the strategy of that influences the situations you depict.
Right, but is he constructing a narrative that gives you an opinion on it? I don't know.
Well,
I mean, I think
that's what
I'm
saying.
Some ways you can't help but do that when you make a movie.
Right. That's all I was saying.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not saying that this is a pro-American, anti-American, or what this is. It's kind of neutral on that. But I do think there are clues to what Kubrick really thought about the situation and how he chose to depict Vietnam, the people. I thought it was interesting that like most Vietnam War films I've seen are in the jungle.
That's a big
part of the character. This felt almost like a World War II flick, and it's all urban conflict. And
that's interesting, because this was filmed on a set constructed in England.
That might be why.
Yeah.
Because I can't really go out into the jungles. It's going to be expensive to do that shit, but I can set up this, you know. And I became increasingly aware of that as I watched it, that, like, this is essentially a block or two of set that just gets filmed in different lighting, different smoke conditions, different angles, like... And I guess that's what I felt like it was a little non-Kubrickian, because it felt a little bit budget conscious there.
Hmm.
You know, like if a real Kubrick movie would have been filmed in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And it would have taken years and, you know, he would have, I don't know. It felt like more of a straight up war film, and where he was, I felt like, and you dispute this, I remember, because we talked about this Friday, but you were like, I was like, I wonder if Kubrick decided to do this because, like, I want to see if I can film just an all out war film and do these stunts and do this, you know, the special effects, and, you know, a lot of the tension in the movie depends on whether that stuff works, and it's not going to be a bunch of weird geometric shapes and intricate set designs and layered backgrounds and rearranging soup cans on a shelf. It's going to be just this gritty thing.
Sure. And I only tried to refute that because of how I know his process works. He basically goes away for a while and he'll voraciously consume media and books, and particularly books.
Sure.
And then he'll eventually hit on one where he goes, you know, I could probably do a a really interesting adaptation of this because the themes in it speak to me.
Do you think that this film is a reaction to the other Vietnam films? That he was saw like a platoon maybe. And he saw a Deer Hunter and he saw Apocalypse Now and is like, this is... All of them are too Hollywood in their own way. I want to do something that's more neutral and nuanced.
I mean, I don't get that impression. I get the impression that he read this book.
What interested him so much about... Okay, yeah. So why do you think he made Full Metal Jacket?
I think he makes it for the same reason he makes all of his movies, which is something in his life that he's either read or experienced at that moment consumes him and his thoughts, and he feels like he has to make something about it. Like, it's the same thing about The Shining. You know, he read Stephen King's work and was like, this narrative structure and the supernatural versus the psychological is so interesting to me that I need to turn this into a film. And this is a book, right? This Full Metal Jacket is a book by another name, I think.
I don't know. I never got that far into it. I got a couple articles that I read. One was a roundtable of philosophers and film critics that did like an analysis of the... especially the psychosexual imagery. And another one that Judd sent is a documentary on YouTube that's about 40 minutes long about...
Yeah.
It's kind of like a mini version of Room 237. Okay. It purports to talk about the deeper themes. I thought the first 20 minutes of that documentary was kind of like a fairly obvious reading of the movie.
Okay. Yeah, when they talk about the duality of humanity and the nature of war,
yeah,
that's... over in the narrative. Come on, people.
But there are, like, the philosopher film critic thing that's called The Duality of Man, they actually had some stuff in there I thought was interesting. For example, and it doesn't mean, you know, this is something where you'd be like, Aaron, this doesn't mean anything. But it's interesting that back in basic training, Private Joker was kind of, you know, you had the drill instructor who was the stern father figure, always disapproving of Pyle, and then Joker was the one that was the patient, maternal, you know, showing you how to do this, showing you how to make your bed, and the guy's got kind of like this idiot loving grin towards the guy. And then at the end, where the drill instructor confronts Pyle and says, what's your major malfunction? Did your mommy and daddy not love you enough? And it's him, it's just him and Joker. Mm-hmm. It's like that Kubrick is intentionally drawing on these paternal and maternal archetypes get at a... Now, again, who the fuck knows?
Right.
Kubrick's dead, and these guys are just looking at this stuff and finding stuff. But I thought that kind of stuff is interesting. So anyway, this documentary, which all this stuff, I'm going to link the stuff that I thought was interesting in my reading about this. They mention a couple things I thought was interesting, and this, you know, the Kubrickian subliminal message types, is that in the final scene where the Joker's trying to get the better of this sniper, that the way that the window treatments and the lattices are forming, and I guess this is endemic to Vietnamese architecture, is that they form these intricate swastika patterns.
Yeah.
Now, in the East, swastika does not mean National Socialism. It's kind of... you know, it has a more spiritual depiction of kind of like the wheel of life, I think, or like the reincarnation and kind of enlightenment. It means more positive spiritual things than it does in the West.
Sure.
So, you know, you could say, well, that's just Kubrick, you know, seeing design elements in these villages and wanting to make it true to life.
Right.
But it's interesting to see how these American soldiers are being put against these swastika backdrops.
Okay.
Then murdering this little girl and then immediately marching to this Mickey Mouse song, which they also go into like the basic anti-Semitism that Walt Disney displayed. And I did a bunch of research because this was all news to me. It's like, I feel like there's abundant evidence that Walt Disney was some kind of anti-Semite.
Okay.
Which doesn't surprise me because a lot of people dated Jews back in the day. A lot of people still do. But I'd found very little evidence that he was a Nazi sympathizer.
Okay.
Which would tie those two themes together. Did you think of anything? You probably think this is all bullshit, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an architectural feature.
Okay, so you don't think there's any intent? You don't think that...
Kubrick's
sitting there looking at the shot selection like, oh, wow, there's like a dozen interlocking swastika behind these young men's... Yeah, that's not interesting at all.
Maybe. I don't know.
Again, it's possible to say.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know. I give Kubrick more credit for that stuff, I guess, than other directors. But
what do you think of the Mickey Mouse Club?
Sure,
what do you think of the Mickey Mouse Club theme? Was this a simple? How many layers do you agree with? Number one, the text is you have these young boys that just went through this horrific experience, and this simultaneously illustrates their loss of innocence and kind of like their morbid detachment to same. Like, I'm going to use this boys and girls like this, like, hey, boys and girls, come join the Mickey Mouse. This is like Mickey Mouse going to war.
Right.
And it's sweeping over, and like, you join us. Like, you either let out your inner American or we kill you. So there's the text. So you agree with that, right?
Sure.
It's just blatant.
Yeah.
You also got the, like, well, maybe Walt Disney was secretly fascist and America is a fascist state and it's a blah, blah, blah. Okay, you got that. I kind of lost the track of where I was going for it, but it's something to do with Joker's closing moments as he's narrating over this is he echoes what Pyle said. I'm in a world of shit, but I am alive and I'm not afraid.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Do you feel that he's not afraid?
Yeah, I mean, I guess afraid is not the word I would use to describe him there, sure.
Well, see, that's the thing, I guess, because it's the last words and it's the narration. I feel like that this has an eternal kind of, this is an eternal statement. This isn't like in the moment. This is I, Private Joker, in the rest of my adult career in Vietnam, am not afraid to die, and maybe in the rest of my life.
Yeah, there's something interesting that Kubrick says about the end of this movie. And particularly when he kills this sniper, he says that Joker is not just a Joker anymore, but a positive life force. He said this in an interview. And I'm not sure what he means by that, but it's got to be tied up in this not afraid sort of thing.
Well, he's finding this middle path. Like I said, the perfectly virtuous Marine would have tried to get this girl medical attention, and probably the whole squad have been shot up, dragging her to the hospital. The mother, the unthinking mother would just leave her there to die of a painful gutshot wound. Who knows how long it'd take her to die, especially since she's begging for death. His middle path was the mercy killing.
Okay.
Granted that, and I feel like, you know, very rarely do people in combat embody the highest ideals of gallantry. And we have the Congressional Medal of Honor to give to those people that do shit like that, to do like just crazy acts of heroism. The fact that, and you probably tend towards doing the more fuck 'em. You know, they were trying to shoot us, fuck 'em. So maybe that is that he was being a force for good.
Yeah, I mean, I can see, you know, that not being afraid as kind of being resolved to the path that he needs to take. Because before, he's just completely lost in this whole thing.
Well, but he's also got a clear, like, he doesn't want to just toe the line of the Stars and Stripes assignment, his journalism assignment. He doesn't want to just give body counts. He wants to kind of find something important and decent about this thing that he's doing. Do you think that, like, going forward, like, what's he going to do when he returns to the States? What kind of stories are you going to tell about the war?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know. That is clearly meant to send me a message, but I don't know what it is.
I don't know. I feel like it's in America, we're at a good place with Vietnam right now.
Okay.
Like
with the country or with the story? Our
just
story
with our
history.
National memory and history of it.
Okay.
That, you know, I feel like during and before the war, there was this rah-rah patriotism that then got destroyed by the protests. And then there's the unfortunate thing of these, again, I don't think you can blame the GIs for the stuff that happened in Vietnam. Like, you know, these people are getting spit on and they're getting called baby killers and they're being, you know, there's this kind of shame about, like, the nation's shame of suffering this defeat and the things that came to light. And then you had the deer hunters and the platoons, and now I feel like that there is some way that we can see that maybe we shouldn't have been there, and there was some terrible things that happened, but there's still a lot of individual stories of gallantry and heroism, and, you know, these, especially since a lot of these men were conscripted, you know, that there's nothing essentially shameful about being a soldier in Vietnam. Like, it's somehow we've got like a pretty good, as a society, I think, a 360 degree view of how we feel about that war.
Yeah.
What did you think? This is another thing I want to talk about, but I forgot. Did you think these men were conscripted? It didn't feel like it.
I got
like
the feeling
it.
That Joker might have been.
Really?
Yeah.
Because he said, like, there was something he said in the narration about, like, this is something he wanted to do. Like, I wanted to be the first kid in my street to get a confirmed kill.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
That doesn't sound like someone that got drafted. Well, shit, I'm drafted. Since I'm not going to college, I might as well be the first guy on my street to kill a Vietnamese.
Yeah, like, no, you're right.
And I didn't, I felt like, and I don't know, again, from...
That seems strange
this,
to me.
Was the army mostly still volunteer at this point? And it was after things kind of turned south at the Tet Offensive that
I don't know. I don't know.
We need
historically,
Dan Carlin to do a 7-part series on Vietnam.
Right, right. I feel like if this were a World War I movie, I could talk much more intelligently about it after having listened to his series on it.
Sure.
But yeah.
Which is hilarious that you feel like after listening to 12 hours audio, you feel...
Well,
you feel comfortable commenting on that war...
More comfortable.
No. What I'm saying is it's. I think it's. I agree with you. I just think it's funny that, like, just because you had one perspective of one person's synthesis of 4 years of conflict, that now we feel like, hey, we're experts on World War One.
Okay. Expert is not the word I use, but
I you know what I'm saying.
I understand your sentiment.
It
yes.
is kind of hilarious to think that you can watch a Ken Burns documentary. Sure. Now I know about the Civil War.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But to the extent that
more
what can
so
you know
than,
about anything?
More than watching The Patriot, right?
Like, sure.
I guess that's the point I'm getting at. Like,
that's the Revolutionary
I've seen
War,
Apocalypse
so you're fucked
now.
If you're trying to... If you're taking away Civil War insights from The
Patriot.
I've seen
Apocalypse Now, so I know all about the Civil War. Of course.
Sure.
But no, I've seen Apocalypse Now and Full
Independence
Metal Jacket.
Day, so, you know, I'm pretty much good on military history.
Sure.
Where were we going with this? Oh, yeah, the Vietnam thing.
Yeah. What about it? We've talked a lot about Vietnam.
But I said specifically about whether these guys were conscripts or not.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, historically, I don't know how much of that time period was constituted by the draft,
uh-huh.
or how much of it was, like, you know, when the draft became a big thing.
Okay, me either.
In the Vietnamese War.
I thought it was interesting. So if none of the perspectives were that I got, anybody was like, God damn, I didn't even want to be here. I was forced to be over there.
Right. That seemed strange to me, knowing that there was a draft.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
So shall we get to some... There's a couple other interesting things that Judd, trying to make a portmanteau of his first and last names. Judd sent us about his experiences with Basic and just kind of his, like, nitpicking of the film. Mm-hmm. Should we get to that now?
Sure.
Yeah, and maybe we have some nitpicks, too. Judd says, most of the boot camp half is very accurate, although my drill instructors were never as articulate as Hartman was, and certainly never used high-minded rhetoric like, God has a hard-on for Marines, but most of the dialogue is accurate. I thought it was interesting that there's other thing that doesn't feel Kubrickian, that R. Lee Ermey was allowed to improvise and write his own dialogue, and that Kubrick is on record as saying, like, I usually got 2 or 3 takes and felt like I had enough from him.
Yeah.
Like, that's pretty fucking incredible that... That guy can just, I guess that's kind of a drill instructor art, that you can just stream that steady flow of, it's dehumanizing and profane, but it's also something that, like, he gives a little bit of praise, and when you finally get it from him, it's all the more rewarding.
Sure.
Like, that's a real skill that they have.
Yeah, I mean, you want to encourage the qualities that are desired, right?
Sure.
And so when they display those qualities, like leadership, not hard-headedness is not the right word, whatever Joker displays that gets him promoted, you want to encourage those things, sure, but you have to break them down also mentally.
Yeah, I compare and contrast this with, like, David Schwimmer as the...
Band of Brothers?
Yeah.
Sure.
Like, he did all the same shit, but there was some respect.
Yeah, they didn't take him seriously.
Just leadership, charisma, something that made what he was doing completely intolerable. Well, maybe the fact that he was kind of incompetent.
He was, yeah. Whereas, and if I recall, he hadn't really been through any shit himself.
Sure. Whereas this guy, so whether he killed somebody, you know, Hartman just seemed like he was squared. Like, you arguing with him would be like arguing with God in this context.
Sure.
You're just not going to win.
Yeah.
He created this world. You're going to tell him how it works? He says, we were never referred to as privates, but rather as recruits. But I guess that's pretty trivial. I never did see a DI lay his hand on a recruit the way that Hartman slaps Joker and chokes Pyle. Technically, he didn't choke Pyle.
Pyle choked himself.
Pyle is his own free will.
He just used the drill instructor's hand.
But from speaking with former Marines who served pre-Desert Storm, that did happen on the occasional basis. The only part in a bull camp half that was completely bullshit is the one that I've always had an issue with, is the final scene where Joker finds Pyle in the head slash restroom with not only his rifle but live ammo as well. There's several reasons for this. Number one, recruits in boot camp are only issued live ammo at the rifle range. Each recruit is given the exact number of rounds each day, and before leaving the rifle range, a recruit has to turn that in the exact number of spent brass cartridges as well as being thoroughly searched. So it's difficult to believe that a recruit like Pyle, a known fuck-up, would be able to sneak off with live ammo and keep it hidden until graduation. Also, the rifle you're issued in boot camp is not the rifle you use throughout your Marine Corps enlistment. The boot camp rifle is turned back into the armory at the recruit depot during the final week of boot camp once all the rifle and field training is completed, so no recruit would have a rifle that late in boot camp. Also, each night, unless you're in the field, rifles are racked, locked, and only the drill instructor has the keys. The scene where the recruits sleep with the rifle in their bunks is also a little bit of bullshit. After the graduation ceremony, which is also in the film, you are dismissed from boot camp. You do not stay at boot camp another night, as depicted. He says, of course, this is my experience going through Marine boot camp from December 2002 to March 2003, so I'm sure it was different for a recruit in 1969. The other thing is, like, I personally know a Marine that walked out of his time in the Corps with a mortar launcher and several mortars.
Whoa, what the fuck?
And there's a story to that, which I'm not going to tell, but and then again, that wasn't in basic neither. That was in some other training exercise, but
Holy shit. I feel
like people overestimate how good the military is in keeping track of every single bullet.
That's not something you just stick in your pocket.
No.
Holy crap.
But yeah, I imagine, and again, like, you know, is this something that Private Gump or Private Poyer are going to be able to pull off?
Right.
I don't know. But I have at least one contra to that
Here's the trivial question I have.
Yeah.
Aside from, you know, the barber being clearly the easiest job in all of the military, all you have to do is just totally take the hair off someone.
You say that until an officer with a stick up his ass wants the perfect fade.
Right. Sure. Yeah, they're the officers.
When you're just shearing the cat to sheep, that's an easy day's pay.
So that leads into it, right?
Like, you got Hartman coming here chomping a cigar saying, you fuck up my fade, my boot's going to be up your ass. Then that's when the pressure's on.
So that leads into my real question. Why do they force the recruits to shave all the way down and then kind of just allow them to do whatever they want with their hair later on?
Well, I think there's regulation.
Joker clearly has a non-regulation haircut, yes?
No, I think that they're, like, I don't know. I don't know what the army regulations were in Vietnam. And also, you know, Vietnam also had some kind of relaxed discipline. I don't know.
It's strange, though, because it ties into that discipline thing that you talked about earlier.
The basic training where, you know, it's that weird thing where they dehumanize you and break you down, but then build you back up and instill the pride in the Corps and the fact that you're a Marine. You're no longer a maggot. You're a Marine now.
But they still don't encourage that individuality, right? Like, a chosen haircut.
I don't know. There's a surprisingly wide variety of hairstyles that is considered uniform, and I think that's. I was reading an article a couple years ago about black women in particular, how there's a current thing of reevaluating that because essentially it's almost impossible and it's crazily time consuming for the average black woman to have uniform quality hair. Because, like, you know, the ways that, like, an army or a marine person can have their hair done, if you're a female, there's a few prescribed styles, and they're all pains in the asses and super time consuming.
Right.
So but I remember when I was looking at the, because there was like, you know, 12 different pictures of an army woman and what they could have. And I'm like, wow, I had no idea that this is the different types of hairstyles you could rock in the army.
Okay.
But you know, you got the, like the high and tight, like who was out of compliance? Like I didn't think Joker
looked the most,
but his hair wasn't over his ears. It wasn't in his eyes. There was no ponytails.
It's longer than I would have expected, I guess. And just kind of, I don't know.
I wonder if the journalism department also like had a little bit more of a leeway.
Yeah, could be. But yeah, I mean, maybe I'm just unfamiliar with the different types of hairstyles. But that was my curiosity. Like, why do they force them? Because it seems to tie into that discipline thing where you would want them following all the rules at all times.
Sure.
Because as soon as they stop, as soon as they relax, it all goes to shit.
Yeah, that's
like,
the beginning.
Why do they let them relax on the hairstyles later on?
If you start letting them decide what rules they're going to obey,
right?
Where does that stop? Yeah, sure.
So maybe somebody who, you know, was in the Marines could tell me that.
That's all I got to say about the movie. You got anything else? Right.
No. Let me ask you this. Where does it rank as far as the stuff you've seen of Kubrick's compared to like a 2001, a Shining?
I don't know how to compare it because it feels so unlike.
What you would prefer to watch again. Like your favorite, that sort of thing.
I don't know that I ever want to watch the second half of this movie again.
Right. That's why it
makes me feel guilty because I feel like that the stuff that I want to watch is all the sugar and the pop and
sure.
You know, it's like if I don't,
the more traditional type.
If I just watch a supercut of Omar being awesome,
yeah.
Instead, in lieu of watching the whole, if I watch 2 hours of just Omar being cool, and decide, oh, I just completed my rewatch of The Wire, it's not fair. Like that would piss off David Simon in particular.
Sure,
I feel like it'd piss off Kubrick if he found out that I'm bored on a Sunday and like, oh, shit, it's 10 minutes into Full Metal Jacket. Oh, Booth made walk. Okay, it's Batman Begins. I'm gonna watch that now. But I gotta be honest, I don't feel like I need to see the back half of this movie again. It's kind of like the same way
with
Deer Hunter. Like, I don't ever want to see Deer Hunter again. Now, if I force myself to, I'd probably come to a deeper appreciation of the movie. Whereas The Shining, I could watch that again right now. Doctor Strangelove, I could watch that again right now.
So I think my hierarchy of watchable, like, if you say, hey, we're gonna watch a Kubrick movie,
yeah.
And in any typical state, mental state that I'm in, I probably go automatically to Dr. Strangelove, then The Shining, then maybe Clockwork Orange.
What do you think about 2001's watchability?
It's pretty low.
Right?
Like, this might be higher in watchability than 2001.
Look, I feel like 2001's a movie.
It's
like,
really fucking interesting. But
I've got the itch to watch it again because it's been about 5 or 6 years. And it's one of those things where, like, every time... You know, you change as a person and what you see, and it's one of those movies, but it's not something you watch like, I'm going to pop a bowl of popcorn and have fun watching this movie.
Mm-hmm.
This is something I'm going to have to turn my brain on, and I'm going to be I'm not just going to be watching it to watch it. I'm going to be watching it for what I can mine out of it this time.
Yeah, and I don't think that's a failing of the movie. I think it's just, you got to be in a certain mindset
to watch
this. But the back
half of Full Metal Jacket... I don't think, because it is so un-Kubrickian, I don't know that it would reward multiple watches the same way. Like, not only is it not fun to watch, but I don't know how much there is there, because a lot of the messages that surface and some of the other stuff, like whether Mickey Mouse is a Nazi mascot, is, I think, kind of uninteresting and beside the point.
Yeah.
So
I agree.
But I don't know.
Okay.
It feels,
sounds like we're roughly on the same page about
it
this.
It feels fundamentally less complex than some of his other. Then I'd throw like Spartacus is kind of the same way. Spartacus is fundamentally kind of, it's just a story you watch.
Right.
It's well told, but if I would go back and watch it now, I bet I would say it kind of feels un-Kubrickian as well.
Right, yeah. There are a couple of his early films that I think he even thinks the same about. Before he kind of became the director that he wanted to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you've done any kind of art, you know the phenomenon of going back. Like, I even experienced this as a programmer. Like, what fucking asshole wrote this code? Look at the comments in the repository. Oh, shit.
It's me.
It was me.
Right.
You know, it's like, and it's sometimes, it depends, it's the other thing. It's like, the more, it's weird. The more of an amateur you are, the easier it is to fall in love with what you're doing as you're doing it.
Sure.
And to look back at it and be like, ah, I did a kick-ass job. And the better you get, the more filled, at least for me, your work is with self-doubt. And you look back at some of your early stuff, you should be proud of it. Just like, oh, that's shit. So I'm sure Kubrick,
as an
above-intelligent, obsessive person, really probably hated some of his early movies.
Yeah, he did. I wonder how a director like Steven Spielberg would look back on his work, his earlier stuff.
Well, you like, know, he thought there was way too many fucking guns in E.T. had to airbrush those out and put shitty rotoscope walkie-talkies in the agent's head. So I don't know.
But someone who's more there for that sort of spectacle and that sort of narrative hook.
Yeah.
Right?
Like, I bet that's kind of what I bet that seems like such a human... That seems like such a human part of the embedded part of the human condition, just being embarrassed with the stuff growth. You did before.
Just basic growth. Yeah.
Because that's what led to him, like, oh shit, I've got these guns pointed at children. What the fuck was I thinking?
Yeah.
You know? Whereas if you have the.
Well, he wasn't. That's the thing, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but also, maybe sometimes that darker material appeals to children.
What about, like, a Joel Schumacher? What about, like, Michael Bay? What do you think they think about their older stuff? Probably not as technically impressive. Like, oh, yeah, I could have made that explosion bigger.
Well, that's a good... It's like Michael Bay, I guess, would be the one that is...
Still doing the same thing he's been doing.
And I feel like he's kind of proud of it.
Uh-huh.
But you also got, like, you know... Joel Schumacher is a good example.
He's interesting.
I made St. Elmo's Fire and The Lost Boys and Falling Down.
Right. That's
Falling Down, one of my personal favorite movies. It's very interesting to watch that. And I you know. But he also made Batman and Robin.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
Pretty bad.
So that's a guy, like, I don't know what to think about him. Who knows? And then you got the concept of selling out. Like, did Joel Schumacher does he know that he's making shit and he just doesn't care anymore?
Yeah.
Like, I made my good stuff. It's still good. You know, like Jay-Z, if you want to hear my old shit, buy my old album. Like, I'm just fucking around for me now. I don't know, man. Anything else you want to talk about?
Nah, that's it.
All right, Judd, thanks for pulling the trigger on this. We had a lot of fun. Well, I can't say that we had a lot of fun watching the movie, but it was an interesting experience and led to a lot of interesting discussion and a lot of research on my part. And I feel like I'm in a full-fledged... I'm going to keep this Kubrick thing going.
Oh, boy.
I'm going to go back and... I actually was shopping for the definitive, like, Blu-ray edition of his stuff. And, man, it's hard to find one. It's hard to find a collection of Kubrick. Like, the most inclusive collection is, like, the scarcest of commentaries, but the one that doesn't have as much of his material collected in one spot has a lot of interesting documentaries. There's, like, this one that's, I think it's $60 on Amazon that has 6 of his films, but it's missing some of the early important ones, but it has 3 documentaries on him. Like, would I be better off doing that, or would I be better off getting the more... You know, just more of your raw films and not a lot of the bonus materials and form my own damn opinions.
Yeah, I feel like I've seen the stuff of Kubrick that I need to see aside from maybe Lolita.
You haven't seen Spartacus.
I don't know that I need to see Spartacus or Paths of Glory or Barry Lyndon.
I've got to see Paths of Glory. I want to see Barry Lyndon just to see a movie that Kubrick hates.
That's what I mean. Like, do I really want to see the stuff that even he doesn't like, or the stuff that's so early that he now views it as just a completely different direction that he took? I don't know. I feel like the big ones are the ones you need to see to understand Kubrick, what Kubrick wanted to be, I guess.
Well, I mean, it's a whole, like, are you doing this with an understanding of what Kubrick is, or you just want to see some really... Because that's the other thing. It's like, I don't know how he feels about Spartacus, but Spartacus is a hell of a film. You know, like, to see a guy... Even if he's quote-unquote slumming on a big Sword and Sandals epic, like, what does a Sword and Sandals epic helmed by a young Stanley Kubrick look like? It's pretty interesting.
Sure.
But anyway, thanks for that, Judd. If you'd like to commission your very own podcast, it's easy. Go to baldmove.com/shop. There's a couple of things you can get off the cart called community commissions, where you pay $10 a share. Once we sell all the shares, we take it down and do it. And also, you can just grow for the quote unquote brass ring and commission a podcast, just like Jed did. Your favorite movie, most interesting movie, something you'd always want to hear what we'd think about it. You can just pull that off the shelf and have us talk about that. Two-ish hours of audio-visual entertainment. A couple of TV shows, a movie, had people do video games, whatever.
A book? Is there a book I can read in 2 hours?
I bet.
Animal Farm, can I get through that in 2 hours?
You get the Cliff Notes, sure. The Spark Notes. Right. Baldmove.com/shop. We'll see you on the next one.